Case 52 from the Shoyu Roku. Sozan's the Dharmakaya. Preface to the assembly. All knowledgeable persons are able to learn by parable and analogy. But when comparisons cannot be made, and when it's impossible to find something similar or identical, how can it be expressed? Main case. Attention. Sozan asked Tokujoza, Buddha's true Dharmakaya is like the vast sky. Its conforming to things and manifesting shapes is like the moon in the water. How can this principle of conforming be expressed? Toku said, it's like the donkey seeing the well. Sozan remarked, well said, but that's only 80% of it. Toku rejoined, how about you, Osho? Sozan replied, the well sees the donkey. Appreciatory verse. Donkey sees the well, well sees the donkey. Wisdom contains, without exception. Purity permeates more than enough. Behind the elbow, who discerns the sign? Within the house, no books are kept. Loom threads don't hang, a matter of the shuttle. Patterns emerge every which way. The intent differentiates of itself. Today is the second day of our session, our Tallahassee fall session, and a wonderful, clear, bright, warm morning. Earlier this morning, walking in the porch, enjoying the fog in the forest, and now the sun has broken through, and a lovely, warm day, and a great pleasure to walk in the garden. Lizards are quite delighted that the sun is out, and they bask and bob and enjoy the warmth as we do. So here we are in our second day, marching forward into session, into this, into the great work. And this morning, atmosphere in the Zendo was quite wonderful and peaceful and clear, silent. And one of the things that we really enjoy in this tradition, Zen tradition, is the co-creation of this atmosphere. We co-create an atmosphere of spaciousness and stillness and silence. And we co-create an atmosphere of inclusiveness and sincere effort. And each one of us, each one of us makes an effort to pay attention, to practice mindfulness, and hopefully to transcend the technique of mindfulness and enter into the world, at least at times of intimacy and no insider outside. But each one of us certainly has, we all have our own ways of making this no effort effort. And this effortful, no effort, and each one does it, and each one of us expresses our love and our determination to be present to life in the form of not only for our own sake, but for the sake of those that we love and our families and friends, and certainly this beleaguered world that we live in. The world is in terrible trouble, it goes without saying. But the atmosphere is informed by each one of our efforts, and each person expresses their concern or their intention to pay attention in a wonderfully unique way. We all have our own ways. Some are quite fierce, and some are gentle, and some are, and of course it changes too with the circumstance, and some are extremely kind and grandmotherly, and others are. But all of these ways, all of these efforts, and all of these intentions to be with and to practice, and all of these efforts arise from the sense of urgency that our life, we have trouble with our reactivity and with our opinions and our kleshas in our life, each one of us in our own way, and the trouble that causes, the mischief that causes in life, our sloth and torpor, our laziness, our opinionatedness, our aggression, our denial, or all of the stuff of kalesa or hindrance causes tremendous, has consequences in the world. I suppose it's not good or bad, but we all recognize that while on one level there's nothing to do, no place to go, and a mind is intrinsically pure, on another level we have a lot of work to do. I say that to myself. That's why I continually, again and again, return to Zazen, the laboratory. Point being that we create an atmosphere together, and I was touched and moved, inspired this morning, and also felt great respect for each of you, each of us, in doing this work, which is no walk in the park, is it? Sometimes, of course, it's spacious and effortless and no problem whatsoever, but other times it's a great challenge, and we each contribute. And the teaching in Zen is that this relationship that we are making with the self, self is making a relationship with itself, is a transmission that takes place that is not dependent on words and letters or signs or convention. In the inclusiveness of this atmosphere, this unimpeded atmosphere that we create together through our efforts, we transmit our aliveness and our way, our wonderful idiosyncratic way, to each other. And that transmission is completely clear. It doesn't appear to be clear, because so much of the time we're trapped in the envelope of our own self-consciousness or our own preoccupations with our own agendas and fears and hopes and whatever, you know, however we get stuck in self-clinging. But anyway, the effort, the purity of our effort and our intention is transmitted, and there's a kind of group, wonderful group intelligence that starts to develop in session that we all bask in, and we all hopefully marinate in. And it's the totality of each one of our efforts. And there's a certain wonderful wisdom and love in the effort, even if it's unknown to us, we still manifest it. And then the group, the atmosphere of the group, it's shared. And this intelligence of the container holds us and nourishes us, and we marinate and we bask in it. It's quite a wonderful thing, so that we can accomplish together as a small group of friends what we cannot do alone, because we are informed and transmitted by each person's wonderful effort. And that's quite a remarkable thing, isn't it? That we have that capacity to learn or be educated in a way, not in the conventional sense. I personally feel that session is, or retreat, is most wonderful educational experience human beings can have, really, because there is this possibility to learn and study and grow in the immediacy of the moment, rather than in the, what does it say in the koan, the knowledgeable persons learn by parable and analogy. Now, but there is another way of learning about and appreciating our life, which is extremely, which is immediate and personal and alive. So this morning we were, for me anyway, I suppose we all come and go, but I was enjoying the bouillabaisse, the stew of us, of our common efforts, and felt and feel deep appreciation that we come together and do this again and again over the years. So thank you, guys. So we've been looking into this retreat. We're looking into this koan, and the language of koan is extremely... is the language of metaphor, and it's also the language of Zen is extremely dense in certain ways, and there are many ways of looking into the koans or studying the teachings of the Buddha as they've been transmitted and come down through this Zen lineage, a lot of different ways to appreciate our life. Koan, as we say, as I have said, and as is taught, means the place, the place where the truth happens, a truth happening place. And of course, the truth happening place is this very moment in which we dwell, and that which is happening, or that which, as David said so clearly this morning, that which is happening, of course, is the reality or the truth. And our job as Zen students is to attend to and be with the aliveness of the moment, to practice with some vigor and determination this practice of bare attention or total presence, total dynamic presence with what's going on, since it's true, not false, and the intimacy that we are capable of experiencing, or at least the mindfulness of, even being in the room is an enormous thing, isn't it? The mind is so incredibly busy and so incredibly active, just running. Even to know that you're sitting in a room is a major undertaking, never mind intimacy with what's going on. But the teaching is of koan, is that koan is the study of truth or aliveness, and truth is a verb. We appreciate or study the truth in the Zen tradition, in the Buddhist tradition in general, but in the Zen tradition in particular, we see that truth is not a noun, but truth is a happening or a verb. It is an activity, a doing. And because life is an activity, we can't appreciate it with a fixated mind. And we can't appreciate it deeply as an object that is outside of us. We have to proceed with faith that the aliveness of this moment is the aliveness of the self. And the self is not yourself, but it is the self. Some people get uncomfortable when we talk about self in Buddhism. They say, well, what about no self? How can you have a self if there's no self? And certainly the three marks of existence that we all study in the Dharma traditions, whether we're Theravadan practitioners or Tibetans, or have whatever resonance or flavor we inspires us to practice. I don't really think at this stage of the game it really makes a heck of a lot of difference what you call yourself, whether you call yourself a Vipassana student or a Zen student or a Soto Zen or a Rinzai Zen or Vajrayana or whatever, but I think whatever it is that inspires us to pay attention and to be more unconditionally present to life is a wholesome and wonderful thing, and all of the traditions nourish and help each other in wonderful wonderful ways. But anyway, we recognize in the Dharma tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, that these three marks of non-self and impermanence dukkha, we could say, are marks of a lot of our experience. And in Zen, we go back and forth between talking about self and no self. And from an experiential point of view, there are two ways of talking about the same thing. Mind always wants to make it either or wants to compare and contrast, or wants to litigate or whatever, argue its case. And there is this tendency in human beings to make it either or, but when we study meditation practice, we are sternly cautioned to not attach to opposites thinking. Opposites thinking is thought to be the root of dukkha, the root of suffering, and the root of alienation and fearfulness, either or kind of thinking, well, it's either this, if it's not this, it's got to be that. We are taught in the Zen tradition quite sternly that this kind of thinking leads to that fixation and alienation and a strategy to find happiness and meaning that is dubious at best, the strategy of greed and anger and denial. But anyway, so this koan is very challenging to enter deeply into it. And all of the, when you study koan, each koan has, koan is about our life, the aliveness of the moment. So if you are cut the gap between yourself and the aliveness of the moment, the koan's clear. Koan of life. And all of these koans are just talking about different aspects of aliveness and the dialogue that we have between ourself and ourself, or the donkey and the well, or friend and neighbor, or big mind and little mind, or husband and wife, and so forth and so on. But keeping in mind that it's a verb and it's not an either or, and that the koans have and most of them have a primary, we could say, root or bone or teaching or pointer or perspective. And then there are lots of supporting ways of looking at this. Now, this koan, the primary perspective of this koan is the teaching of self, what's called jijuyu zanmai, or self-fulfilling samadhi, self-fulfilling absorption. And this teaching of jijuyu zanmai, or self-fulfilling samadhi, is a relational teaching, a teaching of a certain kind of simultaneous emptiness and contingency. And the teaching of shikantaza, or jijuyu zanmai, is that if we can intend to cut the gap between ourselves and our experience, starting out with certain provisional techniques of mindfulness, which are non-aggressive, open-hearted, grounded, stable, and curious attention or mindfulness, if we enter in this way and cut the gap between ourselves and our experience, that the content of our experience, if we enter into it, is aliveness or life. And this life is universal. And this life is beyond conception in its wisdom and love, foundation teachings. And so if we are willing to, as David encouraged us in his own, his wonderful, loving, and gracious way, if we are willing to dare to melt down our opinion and enter into the koan, look into the matter, we will find that something quite inconceivable can happen. So the koan is the donkey. We look into our own mind, our small mind, our idiosyncratic donkey-like nature, each one of us. The kind of stubborn donkeys. Well, I'll speak for myself. I'm definitely in the stubborn donkey category. So a dyed-in-the-wool stubborn donkey, and it takes a great deal of, oftentimes for me anyway, I'm sure the same is for you, a great deal to crack the coconut open. But anyway, we look deeply into ourselves, into our mind. With mind, we self-reflect, or we take the backward step and we look inside in this practice. It's called, in the Korean tradition, Chinul, who was the Dogen of Korean Zen, great, wise, wonderful practitioner, spoke of this practice of shining the light within, or looking within, or with mind looking inside of yourself. He called it retracing the radiance, or in the Japanese Soto tradition, we call it the backward step. But when we look, when the donkey looks into the well, when we look deeply into our own mind and really question and say, look more deeply than that. In other words, where do these thoughts come from? Well, where does the stuff of mind emerge from? What is my essential nature? We call it original face, or what is the nature of my face before my parents were born, or my original face? And with mind, the donkey looks into the well. This is the encouragement of this koan. And looks very deeply into the well. At some point, we come to the place where it is not intellectually ungraspable, but experientially unknowable, ungraspable, and completely mercurial and groundless, vast as outer space. We find ourselves in, we do clearly at times find ourselves in the space of muji, or the space of not knowing. And the space of not knowing, when you get into it and your practice becomes subtle and you move from a certain jhana or absorption in practice into the formless samadhi. And I wish this for all of us, at least at moments, that we can really penetrate the matter, or let the matter penetrate us. And all, we use these different metaphors, so sometimes female metaphors, or sometimes male metaphors, but they are a complementarity, not a competition, certainly. But clearly, when we look deeply into the matter, we look into the mind that is before thinking. We look at the mind that is before thought, and as David said, a habit. We look into the mind that is completely innocent before thinking. The mind which is unfabricated and unknowable, it's completely vast like outer space and completely ungraspable, and also able to clearly, when the mind is in that state of simplicity and purity and unfabricated openness, is able to include whatever aliveness comes before it, doesn't it? You see? So we are encouraged to look into our own mind and to take refuge in that which is before thinking, that which is before contrivance, that is which is before habit, that which is before opinion. The great way is not difficult, it simply abhors opinion and attachment. So we are encouraged to look deeply into our own mind and to come to the place of immense spaciousness and silence. A space we call the Dharmakaya, that pure possibility, formless pure possibility that we all are. And when, even for a moment, or if you are a sincere and dedicated practitioner and you really put yourself into it, you can enter into these spaces that are absolutely lucid. And without even a wrinkle, a trace, or a whisper of thought, like a piece of pure silk hanging in a moonless and absolutely still night, there's no wrinkle. When the mind is in that state of, we say, mu, or not knowing, or before thinking, it is in a place, we call it Dharmakaya, or pure possibility. And this is not the resting place or the intention of Zen practice, to dwell in emptiness, although it is absolutely necessary to experience this kind of jhana and samadhi, to have confidence in original face or original nature. But then clearly, and when I talk about this, it's not necessary that you idealize it and put it outside of yourself and use it as a case against yourself or for yourself. But the interesting thing about Dharma practice is that on all levels it's true. And it's true in the beginning and good in the beginning, and it's true in the middle and it's good in the end. So wherever you are in your practice, working with these extremely clear principles that have been rubbed, scorched, and polished over millennium of human experience, with some of the finest minds who've walked this green planet and have testified to this clarity, not as an opinion, not as an idea or a philosophy, but as a living reality. You dwell to some degree. You look into this well and forget yourself. Then the mind is in a very ripe condition. It's in the state of Dharmakaya, which is pure possibility. And that pure possibility can know, appreciate, be intimate with whatever comes, whatever emerges. And the teaching is that it has, in the deepest sense, no will or reason. It simply reflects and becomes whatever, due to causes and conditions, come in front of it. You throw shit in the water, it becomes a shit water. It doesn't opinion. You know, we destroy the planet's destroyed. No problem on one level. On another level, of course, there are immense consequences and profound suffering. But anyway, so we dwell in stillness at times, and we dwell in that which is vast and unimpeded at times. And the fish has the hook that runs through its gill that keeps it stapled and wriggling and suffering with its own self-clinging and attachment and endless preoccupation with itself. The fish is set free. And Dogen calls this ocean seal samadhi. The fish is out of the net, free of self-clinging. And there is no greater joy than to be free of yourself. No greater joy than to taste the absolute. No greater meaning, no greater beauty than to know or have some intimation of God's raiment. All of the spiritual traditions urge us, encourage us, say, for heaven's sake, give it some time. Give God her due. But anyway, in that state of possibility, clearly something can happen. And it does happen, since the Dharma is an activity. It's not a fixed state. The intention is not to dwell in emptiness, but it is to taste the Dharmakaya deeply. And then what? You hear an acorn drop on the deck, and you are quickened and awakened. And you are quickened by something that is not outside of yourself, but you are quickened from inside your heart of hearts by this activity of life. And who is it that knows that that click? Yeah, who is it that hears that sound? In that moment, there is no separation, and the what is this becomes the what is this. Right? The not knowing becomes resource rather than liability. And the not knowing appreciates its particular manifestation as this sound, or this sensation, or this smell, or this touch. And we call that a koan study, or appreciation of self-nature, and this empty self that was empty of thought and preoccupation and abiding in empty space, then is filled with what? Filled with the sounds and the smells and the sensations and the feelings and the whole stuff of life. And life is not empty. Life is full. And we then enter the bodhisattva way and have the intention, because our compass setting is very, very clear. Not that we can maintain it, and not that we aren't just all of us, you know, baby bodhisattvas in our diapers and all of that, peeing on ourselves all the time. I certainly include myself. But we have the capacity to set the compass setting due north, and it's really clear when you have that. And in your heart and in your blood and in the marrow of your bones, you know it's true, because there's nothing else, and nobody can take it from you. You found your own true self, and it's really clear. Does it stay clear? No. Then we start to, having known that mindfulness and pure presence is a way to be with things in a non-reactive, skillful way that actually works better than greed, anger, and delusion, hard training, and we have seen and touched to aliveness or intimacy, where in that moment of flash or synapse, the nature of intimacy is absolutely unfabricated and pure. it's complete. We do all kinds of things with it after, but in the moment of looking, of seeing, or touching, or being touched by, in that moment of bzzzt, the bzzzt is unfabricated, right? And then we say, all right, well, what then? Now, what is the practice? And again, this is not linear. This is not. The Dharma is not linear, it's an alpha helix. We circle around the stupa, and again, same sticking place, but each time, you know, working it in a certain way. But then what's the challenge? Then the challenge is to personalize the teaching that we know from our experience is true. True because, not because of, yeah, study is very, very important. You'll hopefully study the sutras to support ourselves. But then we want to personalize this self-realization, and the way that we personalize it is cultivate a practice that is daring enough to participate in more of life. Now that's, you know, that is a fearsome thing. Cultivate the steadiness and the calm abiding and the jhana and the fudomyo, the one who just doesn't move, not out of rigidity, but out of love and devotion, is willing to enter into anything. And then this is koan study, self-study. How do you manifest one true nature while walking? How do you manifest one true nature while eating? How do you manifest one true nature when embracing your lover? Hopefully not doing the crossword puzzles. So then we personalize it. How do you manifest one true nature with loss? Even there. So this is a self-study. And the Dharmakaya body is completely empty and unfabricated. And the Sambhogakaya body, the body of appreciation, or the body of bliss and the body of love, is an encounter, is a relational practice, is a synapse, is an intimacy, is a connection, is a way of knowing and loving and appreciating, right? So this Dharmakaya body, this empty body, has the capacity to know in its immediacy a kind of knowing that's not dependent upon thinking, not dependent upon philosophy or thought or idea or agenda or any of that stuff. We all know this, you see, but we forget, and we think we can get to intimacy using this crazy backseat driver who's got opinions about everything. Oh, let me tell you, oh, it doesn't look too good to me today, I'll tell you that. So I wouldn't do that if I were you, and besides, it won't work. You know? What a guy, you know, what a guy, listen to him. Right. So we personalize, and that's it. And that. So, Dharmakaya body, formless body, Sambhogakaya body, these are foundational teachings in the Buddhist tradition. And it's helpful to have a little map, but not that the map will end. Is it the body of intimacy or connection or synapse? This? Uh-huh. Or the look or the taste and the oneness, the immediacy. The boundlessness of, in the whole universe, nothing but the call of the bird in the early morning stillness. And the Nirmanakaya body, again, is the functional body, the do-it body. You taste something by your own experience. You taste the stillness and the goodness of essential nature and the freedom and the beauty of it. And you look at this miserable, suffering world gone mad. Trying to enact strategies for happiness and meaning that just don't even have a freaking handshake acquaintance with this, what we're talking about, and stubbornly pursuing it, you know? You know, them's fighting words, right? Boom. And we are called to do something because we see that this doing nature, this impermanent doing nature, is not philosophical, it's alive. And moist and intelligent and loving and can respond to, and it is a verb or an activity. So maybe return to silence and let's pull up our bootstraps and quit fooling around.